Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want to listen to it, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. We have a packed show today. We're going to be talking about The Merchant of Venice. That is going to be performed at the Santa Fe Playhouse. We're going to be talking to Somos Un Pueblo Unido about things coming up for immigrants' rights. We're going to be talking to Dr. Glenn Leonard about the Mountain Meadows Massacre. Right now, I'd like to welcome Carol Horwitz. She's the City of Santa Fe's Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault Coordinator and is here on the occasion of Domestic Violence Awareness Month, which is this month.
Good morning, Mary Charlotte.
Welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Even talking about this rather distasteful subject, domestic violence.
But I'm glad to have this opportunity to raise consciousness in the community about what's going on.
What is going on? What are the largest, how would you say this, problems within the category of domestic violence?
I think that the largest problem is that it exists. Domestic violence, sexual
assault. How do you define domestic violence?
Well, it's defined as violence between people that have an intimate relationship, but it's not just like men and women or partners. It can also be long-term live-in.
Have to live in the same house for it to be domestic violence?
If they have a relationship, it's domestic violence.
So even if it's like a friend or relative who lives somewhere else,
right?
And so there is this problem of violence. What does it look like? I mean, is it mostly men hitting women? Is it mostly adults hitting children?
Well, child abuse is a whole different category, and we're not even going to get into that except maybe peripherally in our time. But it tends to be men hitting women, not necessarily hitting physically. It can be emotional abuse. It can be mental abuse. It can be withholding finances. It can be isolation. Domestic violence takes a lot of different forms.
And when it's physical abuse, the police get involved. When it's those other things, presumably they don't.
Well, the police can get involved when, a lot of times, like in the summertime when windows are open and couples are having loud arguments or there's crying or weeping and a neighbor calls, the police will come. And that's one of the things that I really want to encourage people who are listening to the program today to do, is to call 911. If you suspect that there's if you think it may be violence, if you suspect, call. Please call, because the thing about domestic violence is it tends to escalate, and then it usually starts as verbal abuse. And if it goes unchecked, it can end up in a murder, a homicide. We have seen that, and it's frightening. We want to intervene as early as possible, and there are a lot of really great programs that can provide that intervention. Esperanza Shelter for Battered Families, they do counseling not only for victims but also for perpetrators and for children. And what has to happen in order for that cycle has to be interrupted at the earliest possible time.
So what do you do to spread awareness among the people, and what kind of awareness do you think is most important?
Well, what we're doing right now in Santa Fe is we have a coordinated community response council, and these are diverse agencies, social services, criminal justice, courts, probation, parole, teachers, city workers, state employees. It's a very diverse group, and it has to, in order for this epidemic to end, we have to work it from all angles. So it has to be happening in the schools. It has to be happening in the churches. It has to be happening in the synagogues. It has to be happening in the business community. It has to happen from a variety of venues. And perpetrators have to be held accountable. And law enforcement, criminal justice, probation, parole, all those agencies are really, really important.
I would think that when you are encouraging people to call, or even within families where there is a problem, the wanting to keep the police out of it or the thought it's none of my business would play a large role.
And that is a really big problem. And sometimes victims, you know, the police will come to an incident where there's been a lot of yelling and screaming and crying and weeping, and they'll come and both the victim and the perpetrator turn on the law enforcement officer. They don't want them there. This is their personal business. But it ends up, once again, if it goes unchecked, it can escalate. And the thing is that when children witness domestic violence, they are so much more likely to become victims or perpetrators themselves. And the emotional and financial cost to their families, to their lives, is just enormous. So we do want people to call, and we do want people to get help.
I have here some domestic disturbance statistics provided by you, provided by the city. And one thing I noticed is that in the warmer weather, there's more problems. Is that a coincidence?
Well, no. That makes perfect sense because people have their windows open and they hear more things. So, yeah, it makes perfect sense.
And there are far more male than female perpetrators.
And these statistics aren't, I don't think that they're really reflective of what's going on, because nationally they would say maybe 95% male perpetrators and 5% female. But what happens a lot of times is a female is written up as a perpetrator when she's defending herself or defending her children or defending her pets or lashing out after having been abused for a really long time. So it's more reactionary, but women still can become incarcerated.
One of the things that's also rather disturbing is the high number of child witnesses to violence.
Right, and this number does not nearly reflect what's really going on, because when there is an incident and there's high lethality, law enforcement and dispatch, they're more concerned with separating the victim and the perpetrator than they are with figuring out. I mean, they are concerned about the children. That is definitely true, but the first business is always to separate the perpetrator and the victim, and sometimes the children get lost in the problem.
So what are the main root causes of the kind of domestic violence that we're seeing here in Santa Fe?
Oh, the many main root causes. Sometimes in the domestic violence field, people say, well, men perpetrate domestic violence because they can. Sometimes people say, well, there's male privilege and entitlement. They say that it comes out of a patriarchal society. In New Mexico, it's really complicated. It has to do with all of those things. It has to do with poverty. It has to do with substance abuse. It has to do with frustration, oppression, racism. There's so many diverse reasons for it. And
because they can sounds kind of specious. I mean, I don't know anybody who would hit somebody just because they could.
Yeah, but that's true. That sometimes that is the reason why.
Because
because they can get away with it.
Because they're taught that it's okay.
And they're not held accountable for it. Because up until, you know, recently, it was normal for men to hit women. It was considered okay. It was considered nobody else's business. It was considered a family matter. In some communities, and I've done research in other communities, not Santa Fe, and people have said, well, domestic violence, it just happens, so get over it. Get used to it and get over it. And that kind of attitude is not particularly healthy.
And you find that on the part of women as well, of the victims?
Yes. We want to interrupt that cycle. We have to interrupt that cycle, because if we don't do something about it now, our children are going to grow up to be perpetrators and victims.
What are the most effective ways of interrupting the cycle that you've actually seen in real life that worked?
Well, perpetrators, what they found in terms of research is the more times a perpetrator is held accountable, the less likely it is for him, and I'm going to say him because primarily it is a him, more likely it is for him to not act out. There are batterers re-education programs, and what they do is they're not anger management. They really teach communication, accountability, responsibility, alternatives to violence, the social issues that have contributed to perpetrators feeling like they're entitled to get whatever they want from women sexually, financially, in terms of service, in terms of waiting on them. So those perpetrator programs are helpful. They're not perfect. Incarceration helps. Women need to be also...
Incarceration helps. So they come out and they say, gee, I think I won't hit anymore because my time in jail has made me reflect.
No, they say, I didn't like being in jail, and when I hit, I go to jail. So I better not hit anymore.
So it really does work.
It has been found to be effective. I wouldn't say it's a surefire treatment for perpetration, but it does help.
Now, what is the Coordinated Community Response Council?
Yeah, that's what we're doing here in Santa Fe, and that is how we are addressing domestic violence. We're pulling together interested people from a lot of different agencies, and we meet every other month for an hour and a half. And we have all these different work groups. We have these great work groups. We have, like, for example, we have a faith community work group, and the faith community work group is holding a faith summit on domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking at the end of this month. We have a public awareness work group, and they've developed a little public awareness campaign, which will be coming out this month. And we have a substance abuse social services work group, and they're going to be developing some trainings for people in the substance, alcohol, tobacco, and other drug field so that they can include domestic violence and sexual assault awareness in their trainings. We have a medical awareness work group. So there's 12, a lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, questioning, and intersex work group.
And all these things, I mean, it's a lot of people. It's coordinated. I've got two things that I want to ask you about that for our listeners who are listening. One is, if people want to get involved in joining these work groups or having input into them, how do they do it?
They can call me at 955-5018. 955-5018.
And if there's a woman listening out there, or a person listening out there, or a young person, man, woman, whoever, who is feeling uncomfortable in their own situation, feeling that they have been victimized or might be in danger of being victimized, what's their best response when they're not in the emergency situation?
Right. If they're in the emergency situation, 911.
But if they're not.
And they need to teach children 911 also, because a lot of calls are made by children. If they're not in an emergency situation, they can call Esperanza Shelter, and that's 474-5536, or that's actually the administrative offices. They can call 473-5200. That's the actual shelter. And anyone who is listening who has been a victim of sexual assault, I really want to make sure I say this. Santa Fe Rape Crisis and Trauma Treatment Center is 988-1951. And these services are all free.
And so people can call, they can talk to a counselor, they can get other kinds of services.
Right, and help is available and change is possible.
Well, Carol Horwitz, thank you very much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. Carol Horwitz is the City of Santa Fe's Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault Coordinator. And once again, her telephone number is 955-5018. Thank you so much for coming down today.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break right now, and when we come back, we'll be talking about The Merchant of Venice. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Deborah Dennison, director, and Jonathan Richards, actor, and they are involved with the Arden Players presentation of The Merchant of Venice, which is happening at the Santa Fe Playhouse, opening on October 11th and running through the 28th. Welcome.
Yes. Hello.
Hello.
Do you do a Shakespeare play every year? Is that what the Arden Players is all about?
Well, we're actually going to try to do two, possibly even three, eventually. Not sure. We may do Macbeth this winter. I'm not sure. We'll see. Plans are sort of in the works. We'll see.
How did you choose The Merchant of Venice this time?
Well, I think it's a play that hasn't been done in Santa Fe for a while. I think it's a play that presents a lot of current issues that are very relevant to what's going on in the world today. And also, we had some wonderful actors who were available to play the lead roles, so it was tempting.
Like Jonathan Richards.
Like Jonathan Richards.
Do you play the role of Shylock?
I do not. I play the eponymous merchant, Antonio. Many people assume that Shylock is the merchant of Venice, but actually the merchant is the one who has ponied up a pound of flesh to secure a loan for his young friend, and things nearly come to grief.
Is this considered a comedy?
It is, actually. The old rule is tragedies end in death, comedies end in marriage, and this ends in marriage, therefore it's a comedy. But it has a great deal of fairly intense drama, and we've tried to make parts of it funny. I hope we succeeded.
But there are very specifically comic characters in it. There are a handful of clowns who are there specifically to be clowns.
And there's always somebody dressing in drag to pass as somebody of the opposite gender.
Of course, it's a Shakespeare comedy.
Run through quickly the plot of this play for us.
Well, there are two concurrent plots. One is a young heiress named Portia, whose father has just died and left her in search of a husband. And he set up this test for potential husbands with three boxes of different metals, and they have to choose the right one to win her. And the concurrent plot is that a young man of the town, Bassanio, wants to marry her, but he's lost all his money. He's borrowed money from his friend Antonio, the merchant, before and lost it. So he goes back to Antonio and says, gee, can I have another loan? And Antonio says, all my ships are out. But I tell you what, use my credit, and we'll see if we can find some money for you. And he does, and he finds Shylock, who is a money lender in town. And Shylock agrees. Shylock is an angry man who has been very much abused, largely because of his Jewish religion, in the society. And Venice was an extraordinarily anti-Semitic place in the 16th century, as was all of Europe. The loan goes through, the money, the ships don't come in, and the rather peculiar forfeit for the loan is exacted, and they go to court.
Now, the peculiar thing is the pound
is
of
the
flesh.
Pound of flesh.
That's where that term comes from.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it does.
What is a pound of flesh?
Well,
good
it's
question.
As specified in the terms of the loan, it is a pound of flesh to be cut off from whatever part of the merchant's body that pleases Shylock. And Shylock specifies closest to the heart. So basically it means that he has to slice off a pound from the chest, from over Antonio's heart. And it's quite literally that. It is, the old gag about what a lose 10 ugly pounds cut off your head. It's very specifically a pound. And it probably comes... Shylock is somebody who, as played by Paul Walsky, who plays him in our production, there's a warmth, a goodness that you see to Shylock, but you also see the point where he just gets... spit on, he gets insulted once too often, or not just, once too often, many times too often. You can see the process where finally he just gets pushed over the edge, and this man who might otherwise be avaricious, but otherwise fairly kindly, just basically becomes temporarily insane, probably.
It becomes a revenge tragedy, in fact. He becomes so consumed with revenge that he loses all sense of proportion, which is a fairly common theme in 16th century drama.
Now, he becomes consumed with revenge just because this guy didn't pay back the loan?
No, because this guy has disrespected him and his religion.
Because of the anti-Semitism. Because
spit on him in the public square, has scorned him, and also has annoyed him deeply by lending money for free.
Uh-huh. Now, this, as you say in your director's notes, this play has often been called anti-Semitic by readers and audiences.
Unfortunately, yes.
Why is that, and why is that not true?
Well, I think it's misconstruing the intent of the play. We're dealing with a play that takes place that was written in because Shakespeare lived in an anti-Semitic world in London and in his own environs, and he's writing about an anti-Semitic world in Venice. After all, the term ghetto was started in Venice.
That's an Italian word.
Yeah. as a secluded place where the Jews have to live in the town and they cannot live anywhere else. Ironically enough, in this play, Shylock's house is on the Rialto, which is odd. So he's forgotten about that. But then whether Shakespeare ever got to Venice or not, we don't know. At any rate, it's... there is a lot of anti-Semitism, which is quite bold and quite brazen in the play, but there's no reason to believe that Shakespeare endorsed it in any way. I think, in fact, one of the things that's very obvious about this play is that people who call themselves Christians behave in a very unchristian way, and I think that's what Shakespeare was talking about. There are a lot of people who are very interesting in this play, but not necessarily likable. I'd also like to add that we don't actually extract the pound of flesh on stage, even though this is Halloween. It's not a gory play. That may disappoint some people, but I want to reassure others.
We're talking to Deborah Dennison and Jonathan Richards. The play is The Merchant of Venice, which opens on October 11th and runs for the rest of October, basically. What do we know about Shakespeare's sources for this play and his motivation in writing it?
Well, as with
his or her.
Well, yes, absolutely. And I should mention the Mary Sidney Society. They are not only has Robin Williams been a wonderful help on the play, and of course she has written this marvelous book, whose premise is that Mary Sidney actually wrote the plays. It's an interesting argument, and certainly worth considering. They are actually throwing an opening night gala for us, an Elizabethan party. They're all coming in costume. You don't have to, but they're serving Elizabethan period food and drink for the opening night gala on Friday, October 12th, and it should be fun. You can come in costume if you want to. You don't have to, but it's a party starting at 6:30 before the show. At any rate, to get back to your question, like so many of his plays, Shakespeare borrowed a story from somewhere else. There was contemporaneous to The Merchant of Venice, Christopher Marlowe's The Jew of Malta, which has a somewhat similar story, but is much darker in terms of the character of the Jewish moneylender. Barabbas in The Jew of Malta is a heinous villain, and Shylock is not. He does things we don't approve of, but he's not a heinous villain by any means.
Would you consider him a villain?
No, I think he's a human being who gets wrapped up in his own pain and agony.
I would think there's probably so many different interpretations of that character that go on, depending on whether you want to cast him as a villain.
I think if you look at the language, he's a man who does things that we don't necessarily like. But you know, if you prick us, do we not bleed, is an extraordinary speech that resonates even today with those who suffer prejudice. And I don't think Shakespeare would have put that in his mouth if he thought that he was nothing but a villain.
In a sense, there's almost, between the Christians and the Jews, and there's a bit of the Hatfields and the McCoys. It's not... They deride each other with equal vehemence, these Christians, these Jews, but you don't get so much the feeling that the playwright sides with one or the other.
No.
Which is the mark of a good author.
I think, yes.
And it's also interesting because it sort of points out to us the extent to which themes of oppression repeat century after century.
Absolutely.
In literature.
Absolutely, yeah.
So this is running through the 28th of October. You've just talked about some of the special events going on at this time. There's also an event by Robin Williams called What to Look For in the Play.
Yes. We're putting on one special matinee on Saturday, the 20th of October. And we're going to have a half-hour session before the play, a little discussion of what to look for the audience. And then after the play, there's a discussion about it with Robin and some other scholars, and I will join in, and whatever members of the cast would like to are also going to join in. And we're going to have an open discussion about the issues in the play. This is largely a play, I believe, about money and what money does to people. And I certainly think with, you know, what's going on with the credit crunch and mortgages and nasty loans going bad and people losing their houses, it's an issue that's right in our faces today.
To what extent can your average audience who graduated from high school and maybe even college understand Elizabethan English, can understand Shakespeare.
We make an enormous effort to make these plays accessible. I don't touch a word of the original text or change it. But first of all, the actors have to know what they're saying. And if the actors understand what they're saying, usually the audience will. And secondly, I do cut any allusions or imagery which is so obscure in terms of period that the modern audience wouldn't have any idea what we're talking about. I tend to trim that. Every Shakespeare play generally has to be cut. Because
are you allowed
wrong.
To do that? You're allowed to trim?
Oh, every director does.
Shakespeare gets a little testy sometimes.
Yes.
We
he occasionally
in turns
place. In his grave. But every director cuts Shakespeare. It's
you
otherwise...
You look at the Hamlet, which in its full length runs, 4.5 hours?
Something like that.
Yeah, generally not done at that
Is
length.
Is that right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's what the Kenneth Branagh film version of it ran, which was extraordinary because nobody ever does it that long. And the same thing here. If we were to do the full length, it would run certainly three and a half hours.
Yeah. The other thing, too, is that there are two versions of these plays that were published. There were the quartos, which are the kind of like paperback versions that were instantly published just from the play scripts. And then after Shakespeare's death, there were the folios, which were the more formal publications. And all sorts of stuff has been published with these plays. The original version of Macbeth that was published, for instance, had songs that the witches sang that came from another play, from Middleton's play.
Right.
So, we can't really be purist about it. We don't know what was in the original plays as they were produced, how much was rewritten, we would like to say that every word is absolutely genuine and nothing has been left out, but we don't know.
Are you acting in this one, Deborah?
No, I'm just directing.
You have in the past.
I have, but I'm not in
this
one.
She says she's just directing. She is just directing and making the costumes and building the sets and driving people to the rehearsals. And I mean, this is a woman who sleeps about an hour a night.
I'm a maniac.
Well, that's probably a good thing for something like this. I mean, how do you make it work in community theater for a production that has basically pretty strong demands if you're going to pull it off at all?
Well, this isn't actually community theater. I mean, it is at the Playhouse, and the Playhouse is a partner because they're providing the venue. But this is Arden Players production. We try to keep to a professional standard as much as possible. We have a fabulous cast of wonderful actors, many of whom are professional actors and have been professional actors, some of whom are just extraordinarily talented, like Mr. Richards over here. So we run it like a professional show. So far, touch wood, seems to be working.
A certain amount of chaos theory prevails.
Yes. Tell us a little more about your character, Jonathan.
Well, Antonio is a wealthy man. He's probably among the merchants in Venice, among the elite. He has a fondness for young men, and for a particular young man, which sort of softens sometimes his professional judgment. And so he winds up making what turns out to be, and perhaps could be seen in advance as being, a somewhat unwise loan or unwise guarantee. I mean, it's unwise in the first place because he's given this boy money before and it's just, gone down the drain. And there's no particular reason, no matter how cute and eloquent the young man is, to feel that this loan will work out any better.
Yeah, you got to do a credit check.
I'll do a credit check. It's this is, I think, what Deborah's talking about the lessons for us today, and that it being about money. But that's essentially the character of Antonio. He is a nice, obviously somebody who is not unused to sharp dealing because he's made a lot of money, and we know that that doesn't just happen out of total goodness of spirit. But he has made money, and he is well thought of, well liked. But he is an anti-Semite. He has scorned and spurned and spit upon Shylock in the public marketplace in the past. There are things about him that are not particularly likable to our sensibility, although they do not offend the sensibilities of the crowd he hangs out with in Venice in the 16th century.
This is The Merchant of Venice, which opens this Thursday, is that right?
Indeed it does.
At the Santa Fe Playhouse, and there's all sorts of special events. For more information for tickets, you can call 988-4262. Deborah Dennison is the director and woman of all things, making it all happen. And Jonathan Richards is an actor. Anything else before we go?
No, it's the box office at the Playhouse for information. And
if you get a busy signal, just call back.
Yes. That's right. And you can probably leave a message. Thank you so much, Jonathan and Deborah.
Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte.
We're going to take a little break right now, and then we will hear from Somos un Pueblo Unido. Stay tuned. I'd like right now to welcome Elsa Lopez and Juan Carlos de Osis from Somos un Pueblo Unido. Welcome.
Hello. Good morning.
And they are here to talk about the DREAM Act. This is an act that is always coming up before Congress and that you guys just keep on plugging away at. What's it all about?
We do. We've been working, Somos un Pueblo Unido has been working on this issue for about 6 years now. It was first introduced in 2001. And it's a piece of legislation that we really try to push because it is about giving an opportunity to youth, immigrant youth, to legalize their status. And those who are in New Mexico, it's so important because we're having youth from all over the state going to universities, colleges and universities in New Mexico, and now they're graduating with nursing degrees, with teaching degrees, and they can't work legally in this country. And so Juan Carlos here has been part of a coalition of many, many students from all over the state who have formed a campaign, a statewide campaign, to support the DREAM Act in New Mexico. And so he's coming here to share his story.
First of all, good morning.
Good morning.
Hello. Okay, my name is Juan Carlos. I was born in Chihuahua, Mexico. Where I'm not sure if you know where that is. Okay, I was brought to the United States about 11 years ago. I've grown up here, so eventually this would be like my homeland, if you can call it. I've gone up to public schools, elementary, middle school, high school. I recently graduated from high school, Santa Fe, which I'm really proud of. Now I'm attending Santa Fe Community College. So I'm working towards my associate's degree in paralegal and law studies. But at the same time, I was thinking, am I able to work legally inside the United States because of my legal status? And this is when the DREAM Act came. And I think it's a really important issue.
So basically, what it would do, it would give people like you who have good, who've gotten good grades, who go to college, who have a professional degree of one kind or another, who have skills, it would give them the ability to work in the United States.
Right. You have to fulfill certain requirements. And those requirements would be to have entered the country before the age of 15, to have no criminal record, to graduate from either a high school in the country or obtain a GED. And then after you graduate from high school or obtain your GED, you get a six-year provisional status. And while that time, you have 4 years to complete 2 years of college or serve in the military. And then right after those 6 years, you can apply for legal permanent residency. So it is really an earned path for immigrant students to legalize their status.
Now, this has come before the United States Congress. It's come before New Mexico legislature.
We have, it has come before the New Mexico Congress 2 times before the Senate Judiciary Committee, and it has gone by with flying colors, with bipartisan support. We have, in the state of New Mexico, we passed a law that allows undocumented immigrants to go to college without regard to their immigration status, of course.
But, of course, the immigration status is a national thing, so New Mexico can't bestow immigration status no matter how much we would like to.
Exactly. So I think that's why Juan Carlos can talk about why it's so important for him for the DREAM Act to go through this year.
Thanks, Elsa, for giving up such a great summary about the DREAM Act. Okay, well, think about it. As an undocumented immigrant, you come to the United States looking for a better future. All you want to do is work, support your family, and have a good life. But unfortunately, you know, you don't have the legal status. You don't have a 9-digit number, which social represents, you know. So if you go to college, you go to university, you get your degree and everything, then what? You're not going to be able to work.
Yeah, then you either have to take your skills back to your country, which means the United States has educated people who then take their... It's basically creating a brain drain.
It is.
Or the skills are unused where you work in those few kinds of jobs that undocumented people can work in the first place.
So the DREAM Act would give a lot of opportunities, hope, to a lot of undocumented students like myself, you know, to be more progressive in that.
Now, in the past, when this has come before the United States Congress, what kind of response has it gotten?
We have a majority that supports it, but unfortunately it has been caught in the immigration debate that we've had for the last 2 years, and that's why we believe it's been sort of stuck.
So the majority supports it. Why doesn't it get passed?
Because it has, unfortunately for the last 2 years, it has been caught and the immigration debate. And so the last...
But I mean in committees or...
No, it has... Well, it has gone through committees. It has gone twice to committees. And it passed. It passed 16-3, the first one. And the second, it was a voice vote, and everybody voted for it. There was no negatives. But unfortunately, like I said, everything is really slow in Congress. And I think that's why it's so important for us to not drop the ball now. This is a crucial time. That's why we decided to have the New Mexico Week of Action. Starting today, we're going to have a press conference at the University of New Mexico. We're going to have a rally afterwards. If people are up there, I invite them to come and join us. We're going to be this whole week, and the next week, we're going to have a series of events throughout the state because we're launching, basically, the statewide campaign supporting the DREAM Act. And so on Thursday, we're having a student forum sponsored by many, many students and teachers in Taos and the University of New Mexico in Taos at the high school, the Taos High School up there in northern New Mexico. And so I invite everyone that wants to come and join us to please support the DREAM Act. If they want to get involved, if they want to get more information, if they want to get email alerts or text message alerts, we're doing different things that people can be engaged in and participate in this campaign.
What's the phone number that they can call if they're interested?
It's 424-7832.
And is there an email or a website that they can go to?
Yes, they can go to our website. It's somosunpueblounido.org.
Okay.
And we are actually, because this is a youth-led campaign, we have a MySpace website. And so if people want to check that out, it's www.myspace.com/somosunpueblounidonm. And so there they can actually hear videos. We have posted some videos where students like Juan Carlos have given their testimony. We're posting written testimonies as well from all over the state. So this is the week. This is it. Because Senator Reid, the President of the Senate, has promised to bring up the DREAM Act before November 16th to the Senate floor. So we invite everyone who's interested in participating to please join us on this effort.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Elsa Lopez and Juan Carlos de Osis, for participating with us today on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. And if you have any more questions about this, you can always write to me at radiocafe@ksfr.org, and I will relay all information that you are looking for.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're going to take another little break right now, and we'll be back with Glenn Leonard in just a couple of minutes talking about the Mountain Meadows Massacre. Stay tuned. I'd like now to welcome Dr. Glenn Leonard. He has written a book called The Mountain Meadows Massacre, and he will be speaking about this subject on this coming Saturday, October 13th at 3 o'clock at the Museum of International Folk Art Auditorium. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Good morning.
Now, this is another September 11th, 1857, was this massacre that I'd never even heard of. Tell us about it.
Well, it's not very well known, but it's probably one of the most horrific massacres in American history.
Where did it take place?
It took place in the little mountain valley in southern Utah. There were about 140 immigrants from Arkansas headed for California. They're mostly families. They had a large herd of cattle they were taking with them because the market for cattle in California was great. As they passed through Utah, they came into a climate of fear and suspicion. President Buchanan had ordered an army to Utah to put down what he felt was a rebellion and treason on the part of government officials, including Governor Brigham Young, who was also president of the church. So the Mormons in that area were fearful that this army would come in and destroy them, like mobs had done in Illinois and Missouri before then, 10 years, 15 years earlier. So they were really very alert. They were putting away grain and cattle and trying to prepare for war. Unfortunately, as this immigrant party moved south, they had some interactions with local residents, particularly over where can we graze our cattle. And they wanted to put their cattle on the winter range. The Mormons got upset with them. So they threatened, we'll come back and we'll join this army and we'll kill you. They were just threatening. They didn't really intend to do it. But in this climate of fear, the local settlers took them at their word, unfortunately.
And so there was this terrible massacre on that day, September 11th. I mean, we don't want to go into too much gory detail, but what do we know about it, and how do we know what we know?
much of what we know leaked out in the early years. The Mormons were involved. They planned it. Then they got some Indian allies to help them. And they all decided to blame it on the Indians and not tell anybody. But word quickly leaked out that the Mormons were involved. And so we have newspaper reports in California in 1857 telling what was happening, all sides of the story. Some of the best information came in the 1870s when John D. Lee, one of the main perpetrators, was tried and convicted of murder. So the people that came and testified against him were eyewitnesses. And of course they were pointing at Lee, but they told the story of what was happening down there.
Now, you are writing a book about it now. What motivated you? I mean, this is one of those stories, it seems, about which there are different narratives depending on who's telling it and to some extent what their point of view is. Where do you stand in this whole story?
Every history has a point of view. And my colleagues and I have been interested in Utah and Mormon history for a long time. One of my colleagues focuses on Native American history. And so about 10 or 15 years ago, there were some monuments built down there, and I was involved in those projects. And because of those monuments, people started taking an interest again in the story. The last major book was 1950. And so several books have come out since then, and ours is just one of those. It'll be published by Oxford University Press next spring. So we got involved trying to figure out what really went on down there, because the stories that have often been told by church members blamed Lee and the Indians, when in fact there were other Mormons in southern Utah involved in the planning, and of course they recruited the militia, ordered them out to help do the killing. So most of the killing was done by Mormons. Indians were helping, and there were 120 killed, 17 young children who survived. Terrible tragedy.
Now, you yourself are Mormon.
I'm a Mormon, and so we come at it from that perspective. One of the big issues is, did Brigham Young order the massacre? We're convinced by the evidence that it was planned locally. And when they wrote for counsel to him, his letter came back 2 days after the massacre. Took the courier 3 days.
That said, don't do it?
Don't do it. Don't do it. Let them go.
Do these documents still exist?
They do. They do. There are the trial minutes, there are diary entries, there are letters, there are the testimonies of various people privately who said, I want to tell this, that if you need it sometime later on to tell the truth, you can use it. Some of the interviews go clear into the 1890s and even past the turn of the century.
Why did it so capture the imagination of the people of that area so many decades beyond the original incident? Why are people still talking about it?
Because it was a blot on the reputation of the church and on the families who were whose ancestors were participating. And then the descendants of those 17 children are concerned about it as well.
Now, did only children survive? All the adults were killed?
The idea was this. We've got to kill everyone old enough who could tell what happened, because during this week before the massacre, there were other killings and attacks. And the Mormons believed, rightly so, that the immigrants knew that Mormons were involved. So with Mormon involvement, they decided, we've got an army coming. We've got to get rid of these people who will, if they tell that we've already killed some immigrants, we're in for it.
It's interesting that you use the word immigrants, which we now use to apply to people from other countries. Now, if you're moving from Arkansas to California, you're an immigrant.
Those were pioneering times. Thousands were going to Oregon and to California, and thousands into Utah. So that overland trail was loaded with people going west, and they were migrating, usually from the eastern United States to the west. Some were coming from overseas as well.
So you've spent your life as a historian, as a church historian?
I've been employed by the church as a historian for a while, and then for 26 years as a museum director, working with the Museum of History and Art. And then along the way...
And where's that?
It's in Salt Lake City.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And along the way, I've written several books on county history and church history, and now this awful tale of blood.
So Just out of curiosity, why is Oxford University Press, of all people, publishing this book?
They're going to put it out in their trade books edition because they've noticed that other books on the subject sell very well.
Really?
Also, they've done some publishing of other Mormon histories and Mormon studies, and they sell well. There's quite a market out there for books about Mormon history.
Is the main audience Mormon?
Actually not. We see and they see this as as a subject of national interest because there's an interest in violence, in religion. Think 9/11. And think how many religious groups in the extreme portions of their religion get involved in violent activities. It's a way of expressing their fears against people that they don't like or that they feel have been oppressing them. It's like a riot.
Where does the Mormon religion stand on violence?
Mormon religion is for peace.
As are all religions, I suppose.
Sure, ultimate peace, inner peace, but peace between peoples. Mormons go to war when their nations call them into service. They believe in supporting governments. When Brigham Young wrote down there, wrote back to Isaac Haid, he said, let them go, don't tamper with them. Maintain the peaceful situation there with the Indians because we've got to have them on our side if the army comes in and wants to fight us.
So you are going to be speaking on Saturday, the 13th of October, this Saturday at 3 o'clock at the Museum of International Folk Art Auditorium on Museum Hill. Anything else that you want to let people know before we go?
Well, we'll be speaking for an hour and then open the floor to questions, so we hope we get some questions as well.
Dr. Glenn Leonard, thank you so much for being with us. When does your book, The Mountain Meadows Massacre, come out?
It'll be out next spring, and it will be titled Massacre at Mountain Meadows.
Massacre at Mountain Meadows, thank you. Dr. Glenn Leonard, thanks for being with us here on KSFR. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting, and the website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Jazz Hoedown. Tomorrow we will be talking to the great writer and film producer, director Ted Flicker, whose film The President's Analyst is going to be screening this Saturday evening at the Film Center. So that and much, much more on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. Keep your dial tuned to KSFR 101.1 FM, simulcasting at 90.7 FM, Santa Fe's only public radio station. And we will see you tomorrow. Ciao.